From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
And now to word of a possible federal investigation involving our governor, J.B. Pritzker. A WBEZ report says the feds are taking a closer look at how Pritzker got a big property tax cut by ripping toilets out of his Gold Coast mansion.
Governor J.B. Pritzker appears to have been caught off guard by a report by WBEZ Radio that federal authorities have him under investigation.
What I know is what you all know from the reporting that was done this morning.
Do you have any concern there could be criminal charges coming out of this whatsoever?
No concerns at all.
My humble advice to the governor is that before he asks for more taxes upon Illinois families and employers, he should get his own taxes in order.
I spent almost 2 years in this role, and during that time, I completed many dozens of investigations. It was a very, very busy role. And it wasn't until toward the end that I submitted these final founded summary reports. I felt very strongly that it should be published. And I was shocked when the commission rejected that request. It doesn't do much good for the LIG to be able to conduct an investigation if her findings go into a box that no one ever reads and no one ever sees.
I know that members of the commission are committed to making sure that the legislative inspector general's office is effective, but we just had a disagreement in this case.
A former legislative inspector general says the office is broken, and the one-time government ethics watchdog has some suggestions for what needs to change, but are lawmakers going to listen to her? Also, news this week, the governor is the focus of a federal probe into something that came to light during last year's campaign involving an effort to avoid paying more in property taxes on a mansion. Is this a problem for the governor and his agenda? Well, we'll talk about that as well coming up on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler. He's a longtime journalist who now directs the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also, Brian Mackey, NPR Illinois Statehouse editor, and Daisy Contreras, NPR Illinois Statehouse reporter. And joining us today from Chicago, Tony Arnold, who covers government and politics for member station WBEZ. Tony, it's good to have you on once again.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
And Tony, it was you and Dave McKinney who broke a story this week that made many people think, here we go again, a sitting governor in Illinois under federal investigation. So what do we know at this point regarding this?
Yeah, what Dave and I reported is that the governor, J.B. Pritzker, his wife, M.K. Pritzker, the First Lady of Illinois, and her brother, Thomas Munster, are under federal criminal investigation for the property tax appeals that made so much news during Pritzker's run for governor. And we know that this investigation's been open since October and remains active. And this is all about, Pritzker, the Pritzkers buying the house next to their own in Chicago's Gold Coast neighborhood and then taking the toilets out to call the house then uninhabitable, which allows them to get a property tax break. They returned the money back to the county during the campaign after this Inspector General report from Cook County became public and became a big scandal during the campaign. They gave the money back, saying giving the money back is not an indication that we did anything wrong. But here we are now. And I should also say that at the time, the Cook County State's Attorney, Kim Fox, her office publicly said, well, this matter's in the hands of our special prosecutions unit. Now that office is saying we cannot confirm or deny that there's an investigation going on. So while the Cook County State's Attorney's office has changed their answer about what they're saying publicly about their own, look at the subject, now what we're reporting is that this has caught the eye of federal investigators.
And from your reporting, how can you confirm that exactly? As far as how do we know for sure that this investigation is taking place?
Well, we sourced this to a law enforcement source familiar with the matter. And as far as the scope of this investigation, how wide-ranging it is, that's unclear. Dave and I did public records requests for subpoenas and didn't come back with any. but we felt comfortable reporting this story.
And one thing I want to try to clear up here, Tony, is I could understand if the Cook County State's Attorney got involved in something like this, but why the feds? What would make this something that they would be interested in?
Yeah, that's a good question that I don't have a solid answer on, other than I would say that, again, we don't know the scope of these things. An investigation like this could be very wide-ranging. It could lead to many other routes. We just don't know, at least I don't know. And I would say, too, that during the campaign, Bruce Rauner, granted he was a political rival of J.B. Pritzker, but then Governor Rauner was saying that when he took a look at this Cook County Inspector General report, look, there's wire fraud and bank fraud in here. There's perjury in here. That's very heated political rhetoric that came from a political opponent of the Pritzkers. But that was out there during the campaign.
Brian, when we find out somebody's under a federal investigation, no matter the scope of it, there's never a good time for it. At the same time, for Governor Pritzker right now, as he's heading into this final month of the legislative session, a lot of key issues are on the table he's trying to get through. Is this something that could derail his agenda? Is it a distraction? How do we judge right now?
Well, I mean, that remains to be seen. I think his agenda has both things going for it and things working against it even before this news came out. On the one hand, you have Democratic supermajorities in the Illinois House and Senate, so that suggests that he ought to have an easier time. But then again, and that won't change. And it's not like any Democrats, even if you're a Democrat who is going to be running for re-election, your considerations are probably not so much on, what is happening at the top of the ticket versus what is happening in your local district. I mean, if you're a Democrat, whether the person at the top of your party's ticket is under federal investigation or not, you could still be tied to that person just because you're in the same party. I think more legislators who are going to be on the bubble on things like legalizing cannabis or legalizing sports betting or supporting a constitutional amendment to allow for a graduated income tax are going to be thinking about how is my district going to perceive those individual actions more so than that. And so this is, I mean, it's a ambitious agenda he's got. It's a somewhat contentious agenda in, sort of swing areas in the suburbs. And so I don't know that this particular news changes anything all that much. And just to, if I can also come back to one point, you'd asked about why this is a federal investigation, and Tony mentioned, Governor Rauner made a point of this. The members of the Republican Illinois congressional delegation also sent a letter urging this very investigation to the U.S. Attorney John Lush back in October, so about a month before the election. And they specifically said because the refund checks for property taxes were sent through the U.S. mail, that is a potential violation of the federal mail fraud statute. So that's how this becomes a potential federal case.
Well, it occurs to me that most of the items on his agenda aren't going to really be jeopardized, because they only need 60 votes in the House, 30 in the Senate. And the Democrats' majorities are so wide that they can probably easily get that. Plus, there will be some agreement on sports betting, for example, or on marijuana, and it could very well be a bipartisan vote. I think what it really does is give ammunition to the people who are against this notion of having a progressive income tax, because now they can say, they've been saying all along, how can you trust Madigan and Pritzker? Now they can say, how can you trust Pritzker? He wants to raise your taxes and he won't pay his own. He's a tax cheat. He's a fraud. And that kind of rhetoric will heat up, and this is just ammunition for that. But as I say, I think on and the constitutional amendment requires an extraordinary majority. So it requires 6 extra votes in the Senate. It requires 11 extra votes in the House. So that is what I think is really going to be more difficult because of this news about this investigation.
Well, Charlie's a former Sun-Times employee. The Sun-Times went even farther this week with this, saying the editorial board saying that they smelled a setup when it came to this, that they took it as this was somebody trying to derail the graduated income tax. Anybody want to weigh in on that?
Oh, I would say, yeah, maybe it is. But on the other hand, as a reporter, if there's news out there and it's a significant news affecting the public sphere, your obligation, I believe, is to report on that story, even if it comes, if you know that the person who gave it to you maybe has impure motives, so to speak. So I think, yeah, it doesn't help. But on the other hand, part of having an informed public is that the media will let people know what's going on, even if it is information they got from somebody who's got a nefarious purpose.
And I agree with Charlie as well with the issues of that are already underway, like negotiations with cannabis, legalizing cannabis, sports gambling, a capital plan. A lot of lawmakers are very deeply into these issues, so I don't think that it's going to derail any of their plans so far.
Tony or Brian, you want to weigh in on that?
I think what I'd just say is Daisy's totally right. This is being negotiated by legislators right now. A lot of these issues, the graduated income tax language, that's already out there. That train has left the station. Legalizing recreational marijuana, sports betting, infrastructure bill that's going to be worth billions of dollars and potentially controversial in how it's funded. Just the state budget itself, which has many new streams of revenue, if not increased streams of revenue from what already exists, whether it's cigarettes or vaping or plastic bags usage. All these things are already left. And so I don't know that this story does necessarily, again, change a vote on some of these issues when it comes down to, you know, which state representative or state senator is sitting there and is going to hit the green button or the red button. I guess what I'd just say is that we were able to report that it does not appear that any charges are imminent. And also that, you know, Pritzker has not been accused of wrongdoing. Nobody has been. Nobody's been charged criminally here. And Pritzker for himself, as you heard at the top of the show, says all the rules were followed is what he's been saying.
But Tony, I would just ask one other interesting aspect of this case I don't think we've talked about is, didn't you report that one of an assistant to M.K. Pritzker, the first lady, had hired a lawyer? I think that's an interesting angle here.
Yeah, there are two very high-powered attorneys that we know are involved. One is what you're saying, Christine Lovely is the personal assistant to the first lady, M.K. Pritzker, and she has Reed Schar representing her. Reed Schar is now in private law practice, but he was a former U.S. attorney who helped put away Rod Blagojevich. He ran the trial, the prosecution against Blagojevich. So that's noteworthy. Also noteworthy is who the Pritzkers have representing them. His name is Mark Elias, and he's based out of Washington, D.C., but he was general counsel to Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign. And you can think about all the legal issues that went on with that campaign. And also, he also was the general counsel for John Kerry's presidential campaign as well.
I just want to add one more sort of coda to this story, which is I continue to be amazed and baffled by the lengths that extremely wealthy people will go to save themselves a very small amount of money on taxes, relatively speaking. I mean, this is the equivalent of somebody, you know, J.B. Pritzker is worth, what, $3.4 billion? And he, I think, is alleged to have saved a few $100,000. I mean, this is... I don't know. Maybe this is like somebody driving an extra 2 miles to save a nickel on gasoline. And, you know, people will do that even if it ends up costing them, you know, more gas burn to go the extra distance just, you know, because of the principle of it. But like the idea that a man who is worth billions and billions of dollars would go to these lengths to save a few tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars on property taxes. You know, I guess I wish that more people had the means to think about their taxes in that way.
Well, we'll continue to follow this issue, of course, over the next several weeks, see if anything does come out of this. But one of those issues that is also on the agenda as the legislature gets ready to come back for their final month of the spring session, one of those topics that was mentioned that the governor has pushed for, sports betting becoming legalized in the state of Illinois. Daisy, there was a hearing this week. Did we learn anything from that?
Yes. So lawmakers again did hear from stakeholders, and this time it was from the collegial athletic directors, also those concerned with gambling addiction, and a group of people who are pushing for a mobile betting platform that would allow for what they call safer wagering practices. So one aspect that came out of this that I think was very interesting was testimony from Division I athletic directors. We've been wondering here in the show over the last few weeks, Charlie, about where college sports would fit in the conversation. So the director of athletics at Illinois State University, Larry Lyons, spoke at the hearing, and he represented 12 of the 13 Division I programs in the state. So basically, they don't want gamblers to be able to bet on college sports. So if sports betting is legalized, the athletic directors are asking that college sports be excluded from the final bill language. And from the back and forth with lawmakers, it is my understanding that there is interest to keep college the sports in the final measure. Lawmakers say they do see and understand where the athletic directors are coming from. They're worried about players and their safety because they're young, they're students. So the issue is, how do you protect the integrity of the games and give them that safety from dangerous situations? And other states have legalized sports betting have included college sports in their laws. For some, in-game bets are not allowed. And for others, wagers can only be placed when the game is out of state. And I think at least for Illinois, lawmakers are still looking to keep the conversation going with athletic directors and to kind of maybe get the NCAA involved to figure out best practices moving forward.
Well, I got
to
say,
at the risk of sounding cynical, it would be terrible if people actually bet on college games. I mean, nobody does it now, right?
I think you can in Vegas, right? I'm pretty sure. So
legally.
Well, I've got to ask, though, with just a few weeks left here to get this thing through the session, and there's issues like this coming up. There's issues of the platform of how you would actually place a bet. That seems like a lot to get done in the last few weeks. Is it possible this is not going to happen?
There,
at least right now.
I feel like pressure is building. There was this idea that Illinois could probably be the first state in the Midwest, like with recreational marijuana. But actually this past week, legislators from Indiana and Iowa, I believe, sent their governor's legislation to sign on sports betting. So I feel like the pressure is there, and kind of looking at what those measures have in them to make sure that, you know, we're competing and, you know, we're in the market, a competing market where we don't have, if we do legalize sports betting in Illinois and whenever that happens, that people aren't, you know, going across state lines to maybe have a better winning opportunity.
Well over a year ago, stories began to surface. Allegations were made regarding sexual harassment in state government, and lawmakers vowed to take action then. Brian, that issue back in the news this week, former legislative inspector general made some disparaging comments on the process to deal with those complaints. What did Julie Porter have to say?
She basically says that her office is broken. And that it's basically powerless. That's the sort of shorthand version of it. So Julie Porter was appointed this position, as you said, as the Me Too movement kind of blew up across the country and reached Springfield and Illinois government. People suddenly noticed that there had not been an inspector general appointed since the last one resigned in 2014. So there was no ethics watchdog overseeing the Illinois General Assembly. And meanwhile, more than two dozen cases had piled up. And we only really learned about this because a woman who had filed a sexual harassment complaint, Denise Rothheimer, came forward and started talking about it publicly and said that it was ridiculous that she had filed a complaint. I believe it was more than a year earlier at that point, and it had just sat collecting dust. And so lawmakers brought in Julie Porter, who is a former federal prosecutor, very well-regarded attorney and investigator, and she started working through these cases and additional cases that came in. Now, the thing about the Legislative Inspector General's office is if she determines it's not founded, then the report is kept secret. And really, there was only one report that was made public. It was that one that, as I said, Denise Rothheimer had alleged that then-State Senator Ira Silverstein sexually harassed her. Porter determined in her opinion, that it did not rise to the level of harassment, but it was conduct unbecoming for the way he had behaved toward her. And so ultimately, there was no sanction that she could issue or that the caucus, you know, the legislature could issue short of expelling him. And the matter was left up to the voters, who decided not to reelect him at the next primary election. Fast forward to the end of her term, which was earlier this year, she said she had two additional founded reports. And one of them, she, you know, was complete enough to present to the commission. And the commission, which is eight lawmakers, bipartisan, four Democrats, four Republicans, four from the House, four from the Senate, they voted to unanimously to keep that report secret. And she says she was shocked by this decision. It basically shows the powerlessness of the office. She says she needs permission of the commission to open an investigation. She needs their permission to issue subpoenas, and she needs their permission to actually make public her findings. All three things, she said, ought to change, as well as other aspects of the office.
Charlie, I guess I'm not as shocked by this, because it sounds to me like something we've heard through the years, and that is lawmakers taking care of their own, not necessarily worried about always getting the information out there, but more worried about protecting their own. Now, I don't know the details of this specific case, but it sure sounds that way.
Yeah, and from my personal experience, you can go back 50 years, and there is always the concern about if this information is made public and it's some opponent trying to smear me for the next election, that it's really going to hurt me. And so lawmakers of both parties have been reluctant to do anything to regulate themselves. As a matter of fact, one of the former inspector generals, Tom Homer, a former state representative, appellate judge, when he left the office, he suggested they need to toughen the rules. As it stands now, the legislation says that if I'm a lawmaker and I have a conflict of interest, I probably ought not vote for it. But there's no penalty if I do. It's absolutely toothless. The economic disclosure is pretty well meaningless. And Homer suggested, among other things, that there be more specificity in what lawmakers have to disclose in terms of economic interest, that there be stronger sanctions for somebody who votes to feather his own nest. None of that stuff has happened. And I remember years ago, this is in the early 70s, a guy named C.L. McCormick, who was a legendary Republican from Vienna down in Johnson County, got up and said, "We don't want to be naked in the fishbowl," talking about the economic disclosure. As a side note, C.L. was an interesting guy. He was investigated by the feds, too. And I happened to be coming back from Southern Illinois, and I was riding with him, and he said the investigation proved how honest he was, because they found out that he hadn't paid his income taxes, but they found out his only income was his legislative salary and the money from his little big dollar store down in Vienna. So he had no outside income, which I thought was an interesting way to look at it.
And Brian, you wanted to get in one more time.
Yeah, I just want to say, I mean, Charlie highlighted that point about conflicts of interest, and Porter mentioned that, Julie Porter, the former legislative inspector general, mentioned that specifically as one of the things she thought, as well as, you know, Charlie mentioned that Tom Homer made that recommendation as he left, and lawmakers responded by not appointing even a replacement, let alone taking up his suggestions, and Julie Porter made the same point. She also said, you know, she will not talk about, nor will members of the commission, what this particular founded report was about, but she said in a general way, one of the changes she thinks needs to happen are stronger conflict of interest provisions. Because if a lawmaker is up there voting and they may believe to the core of their being that they are voting ethically and doing what's best for the people of Illinois, but if they have a financial interest or they're in an industry that benefits, think of what the people on the other side of that issue might think. And what does that do for confidence in the legislative process in Illinois?
And I also find it interesting that these findings or these recommendations are not only coming from the legislative inspector general or someone who's been in office, but also from other task forces, like, for example, the Senate Task Force on Sexual Discrimination and Harassment Awareness and Prevention. They released a report last year, and one of the recommendations was, you know, we really believe that there needs to be more transparency with the General Assembly and accountability in the way the legislative ethics process works, and they don't think that, you know, with appointing a permanent legislative inspector general is enough.
well, the proof will be in what they finally do. But we're just about a minute or so left here. And, Tony, let me go back to you, because a case that's been getting a lot of attention up in the Chicago area this past week, and rightly so, the awful story of a 5-year-old boy from Crystal Lake. His body was found. His parents have been arrested, apparently, allegedly, for quite a bit of abuse that took place there. And it turned out DCFS here in Illinois had been quite involved with that family beforehand. I know you've been busy with some other things. You may not be covering the case that closely, but this just adds fuel to this fire when it comes to the scrutiny that DCFS is going to receive, correct?
Yeah, this is AJ Friend and is the person who died. This story is extremely difficult to read. Even the headlines themselves are extremely difficult just to see. My takeaway from what I've read so far about this case is about him and his parents, you know, have been arrested and charged with his murder, is that, look, he was born, it's been reported that he was born with opioids in his system. And right off the bat there, I kind of wonder what kind of access to drug treatment his parents even had. And so there's one thing, but also with DCFS's involvement throughout his life, that was cut short. I've done some reporting on DCFS in the past, and that agency, it's gone through so much in the last few years, but they weren't even tracking. I reported a few years ago that they weren't even tracking or had knowledge of how many child deaths there were in which they had involvement of abuse or neglect in the past. There's been all sorts of leadership changes, some of that through administration changes, but some of that through other scandals. And then the other thing, too, is just when you're talking about child abuse and child neglect, there's a lot of information that is not public when it comes to that. Now, some of that's for good reasons, but some of it, too, there's something to be said about transparency and having that help in checks and balances of systems. And that's something else I think that could be brought up with when you're talking broadly about these types of deaths that are just really hard to swallow and hear about.
Time now for our notes from the field. Daisy, let's start with you.
A group of 16 Illinois organizations and agencies teamed up to help the monarch butterfly survive. For Earth Day earlier this week, the team unveiled additional steps that they are going to take, which includes adding 150 million more milkweed stems across the state.
All right. And Brian?
Yeah, some movement on an interesting, controversial idea moving through the General Assembly this week. State Representative Emmanuel Chris Welch wants more diversity on corporate boards in Illinois. He had legislation that would have required one woman and one African-American person on every corporate board. He's now amended that to also say that boards must include a Latino or Latino representative on their board as well. Business groups opposed to this. Even supporters have questions about its constitutionality and how it works with international corporations, But it's an idea that is certainly sparking a lot of conversation about the lack of diversity on some corporate boards.
All right. That will do it for this week. Members of our broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, Daisy Contreras, and Tony Arnold of WBEZ. And a reminder, next week we take the show on the road. State Week will be taped live in front of an audience. If you're in Springfield Thursday at noon, join us at the Lincoln Herndon Law Office in downtown Springfield. You can find details and tickets at nprillinois.org. Production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.